GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, February 8th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, a maker, photographer, thespian, and software engineer. Hello, Lyle.
Hello.
That was my thespian voice.
Oh, good.
Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
I do not have a political junkie voice. And Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler.
Hello, what's your
Ben.
Voice for that?
A world traveler.
You can just pick a country.
All right,
yeah,
nice.
You're going to like... Well, here on the central coast of California, it's been dry, and we are finally seeing some rain. It is so nice. So if you hear a little extra liquid, I guess, in our voices, it's because it's finally in the air.
Yeah, my hair was a little bit wet when I walked into the station.
If you hear a little bit more liquid in our breathing, we're probably going to die.
Yeah, sorry about how we've got pneumonia. We do not have pneumonia. Let's just be clear.
So it has been raining a little bit the last couple of days, and I've been thinking a lot about water because that's, I guess, it seems miraculous that water, the thing that we need to drink to live and everything, just falls from the sky.
Are you asking how rain works? Rain, how does it work?
It's so cool. So I was doing a lot of reading, and I just thought I would share a couple of the things. Some of them that I just brushed up on, some of them that are fairly obvious. But, I mean, it's amazing. So we leave wet dishes on the counter, or we leave a towel sitting around, and the water on it just disappears, seemingly into thin air. So it turns into water vapor. That's the gas phase of water. And I actually, for some reason, I managed to get through all these years of life without knowing that water vapor is lighter than air. And that's why it goes up and forms clouds up higher. It actually creates convection currents, which is basically the air will move around and create little, winds and things like that.
And to be fairly accurate, there's a temperature differential many times between the ground and further up. So that also causes
convection.
It's not just the
When water vapor evaporates, or when water evaporates into water vapor, it also takes away some heat from whatever it's evaporating, which is why sweating and then you being feeling cooler actually works.
Everything is an exchange.
Yeah. And then all the gray that you see above your head today, if you're listening on the day that we're recording it on Saturday.
In the area that we are recording it
that's
in.
That's water. They're clouds. They're water, right? And then sometimes, like today, it condenses back down into a liquid, falls from the sky.
Clouds are in fact little water droplets. That is the water form, not the gas form. The gas form you cannot see.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And
said the vice
Tell
president
me more.
Of the Society.
When you were talking about when it evaporates, it cools off.
Yeah.
When clouds form at that layer, there's actually a heat increase in the surrounding air.
Mm.
We've just seen a microcosm of...
That's where you'll see actually the... as it rises, and you'll see this plateau where the clouds... there are no clouds, and all of a sudden clouds exist. That was just the point where the adiabatic cooling had caused it to...
How many syllables was that?
To have the water 10. Condense... And then it causes... And then you have a heat differential there, and it doesn't... it's not a smooth transition. That's why there's that hard boundary.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just seen a very typical dynamic here among a couple of the geeks. Ben is in charge of the wander, and you are in charge, Miles, of the actually. Fantastic.
The pedanticism. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And then...
Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, I took a class in meteorology. Like, I never get to use that everywhere.
I have not taken a class in meteorology, so I do appreciate it. And then also, one other thing. I mean, so we know that water covers most of the planet. It covers 70% of the planet.
Yeah.
And incidentally, also makes up somewhere around 2/3 of the human body. And it depends on actually who you are. If you have more fat, you tend to have less water, and vice versa. Women tend to have the least amount of water in their bodies, and then men, and then children, and then babies actually have 78% approximately of their of their bodies are water.
You can just
constantly overflowing into all surfaces at all times.
Reported it's the young father.
Out of every orifice. So anyway, yeah, I mean, that's what I got. I mean,
that explains why I'm so
all this other cool stuff. If you feel like doing a bit of Wikipedia surfing, you know, there's this thing called heavy water, which is just kind of wacky. I'm not going to talk about it right now. But yeah, it's really cool to read about what it is and also some of the different effects that it has on life. Yeah. And
if you want to know more about its effects in our greater environment, I highly recommend the meteorology classes at Cabrillo College.
Ah.
You know, now that you've taken those meteorology classes, you probably understand what's going on with the lightning bolts affecting wind turbines.
Yes.
This How's was that a, for a segue?
I was covered in college. It was amazing.
As it turns out, that is an issue with wind turbines, is the fact that even though you'll have other metal structures that are of similar height in the area, wind turbines seem to attract more than their share of lightning strikes. And when they get those lightning strikes, even though precautions have been taken to ground them correctly so that it just like many buildings will have a lightning rod to prevent any damage to the structure, the wind turbines are actually having some issues where you're having damage and they're having to be replaced on a more regular basis than one would expect from lightning strikes.
But why, Miles? Why?
That's actually an open question.
Oh, we don't know why. Okay, so that you didn't cover that in meteorology class. All right, I get it.
No, we didn't cover the wind turbines in meteorology class.
But the way that lightning affects them. Well, okay, well, that's interesting, because I would imagine, just in my little, you know, Bonnie brain, that it'd be because wind turbines are like waving metal around going, yoo-hoo, lightning, here I am. But maybe that's not how it works.
I'm sure that actually is a strong contributing factor.
My naive five-year-old brain says, oh, it's sucking all that lightning in with all the air and that. No, I don't know.
Yeah,
on a few occasions, periodic flashes about 3 seconds apart were detected over wind turbines, one lasting over an hour. These turned out to be very low energy discharges that sparked upward each time a blade of the turbines swept past the high point.
Oh,
wow.
So it was really pretty.
That would have been.
Yes, I
want
to see that.
This story from Ars Technica, which we'll be linking to the show
at our website, geekspeak.org.
I want a video of that.
I
probably could. If I was there, I could definitely watch that for an hour. Spark. Also, if I was there, it'd be a bad idea.
Especially if you're all in the windmill.
But they've had some. They have had some issues with the. With fires.
Yeah.
Less good.
Which actually, if I can just take one moment to cover a greater issue with regard to wind turbines. First off, I love wind power. I love solar power. But
Is that because you like to talk so much?
Sorry. Oh, yes. This isn't the Nog Miles
show. Go on. You love wind power, you love solar power, and?
Although I did laugh. I know.
However, I do want people to recognize when they say, we should drop off all fossil fuels, drop off nuclear, drop off all these non-renewal, or I should just say non-green energy in favor of just solar and wind. And I think of the polar vortex storms that have swept the country over the last month or so. If we were solely wind and solar, there would be a whole lot of people without power for an extended period of time when it's really cold.
Yes. Absolutism isn't normally the way to solve political
There needs to be
problems.
A solution that covers that. And batteries don't work well when they're really cold. So that is not the solution.
Yeah, it is important to keep in mind that everything's kind of within moderation. You can't take a good thing and say, let's put it everywhere all the time immediately. No, that's a bad idea.
Besides, God doesn't like wind turbines. That's why God hits them with lightning bolts.
Yeah, okay.
And, no, is that not how it works?
And bringing it back to the software sector, when you're in a big company, you roll out to a small percentage of your users first to make sure that it works, right? And then you roll out to a slightly larger, and then a larger, and then a larger. And then finally, eventually, once you're really certain everything's going to work, you roll it out to everyone. That catches bugs. That catches unexpected changes in usage or any of these things.
I wonder how they're going to solve the lightning bolt wind turbine problem. Because it seems like it's always going to be a problem. If you put a tall structure up, that's where lightning will hit. I wonder if you'll just make the turbines strong enough over time where it doesn't matter.
What if you put a lightning rod at the end of the blades?
The mast above the blade, higher than blade point.
And you allow some current to be able to pass through.
I mean, it'd be kind of cool if you could use it somehow.
Isn't that kind of the point of wind turbine? Wait a minute. harness the energy?
Don't know. That's to harness
the energy of the wind, not of the lightning striking it.
I was thinking lightning strikes aren't predictable as to when they're going to happen, but they're also highly variable as to how powerful they are.
Yeah.
And the really powerful shots, I don't know if we have a way of really
claiming a whole bunch of energy expert putting really tall structures up that have a pulsing action of pulling lightning bolts. It seems like we're getting closer to going, maybe we could use it.
Well, yeah, but we can see this on, a few wind turbines, but what if you have 100? Which ones are going to be the ones that get struck?
Of course.
Listen, guys, I'm not really where to go from there.
Well, we could talk about PC sales in 2013 and what they look like at current day.
How they're comparing?
So in the end of 2000, we all hear this, that PC sales are falling because of tablets and phones, and people aren't buying as many. And so IDC's worldwide quarterly PC tracker shows that 82 million units were sold in the fourth quarter of 2013. And that's actually a decrease by 5.6%. And it was actually predicted that it was going to be a 6% decrease. So that means that almost 6% less PC sales happened in the fourth quarter.
And
fewer. Thank you. Oh, whew. Good thing we have Miles here.
Vice President.
No one understood that. And so the thought process goes, people are using tablet devices and phones to replace, in some sense, PCs. And then, the diehard computer programmers, like people like us, actually type all the time. There's no way we could do our jobs on tablets. So it always becomes as well, it's not going to replace it all. But
because keyboards, mainly.
Yeah,
because
keyboards. We like keyboards.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, yeah. It's that's the main factor, I would say, right?
Yeah.
If you're doing real computing, you need a keyboard. You can't use a stylus and go tip, 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 tip.
Yeah. There's another thing too, though. When you're lounging with a tablet device and you're looking down on it and you're using your hands on it, there's a software keyboard on there. But the angle for the software keyboard is not really right for your hands, right? Mm-hmm. It's like why we use tablet and drawing pads. They're drafting table angles. When you draw, you're a drafting table. When you're looking at a screen and you want to sit properly and for long periods of time, actually a more vertical surface is correct. That's why televisions work so well in movie theaters and computer screens. Mm-hmm. So
The other side of it is, but in addition to that, software keyboards, the keyboards on the screen of tablets, you don't get any physical response. And so you end up needing to look at it a lot more. Whereas when I code, I don't look down at my fingers when I'm typing at all.
Right. You're talking about registration of your fingers and actually knowing whether you hit or not.
Yeah, you can feel where the keys are.
Well, that's interesting is that this always has been the discussion. And what I realized, I was in new media art kind of space where different ways of interacting with computer systems and with audiences were always being explored, right? So you'd have a sensor where an audience member would come in and the sensor detected that they showed up and therefore something happened. These are minimal things. They're not highly rich gestured interfaces like a keyboard is pretty highly rich, especially someone like Ben who knows a whole bunch of keyboard shortcuts, or someone like you, Bonnie, who flips your screen accidentally before the show. That was pretty
funny. I had no idea how that happened.
Just the keyboard. There's a lot of input capabilities in the keyboard.
Yeah.
And we're trained to use it. And the thing that I find interesting is that actually, we spend years in elementary school learning to read and write English. And therefore, it makes sense to take advantage of all of that knowledge and put an interface that extends that capability.
That's how we've been educated so far.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, these things could kind of feed into each other.
Yeah. So I noticed this week that the Facebook Paper app showed up, and it became very popular. It's an iPhone-only app. I'll link to it. But basically, it doesn't have back buttons. It doesn't have the kind of interface that has been traditionally done. There's a lot of gestures to use it. You have to know a few things. And I realized that our gesture language capability in a tablet device and a touch device has increased. Mm-hmm. And my children's are going to be completely different than mine. My children actually, I think, use touch surfaces more than keyboards. And I'm just curious that the reason why keyboards currently don't work very well on touch surface, as you mentioned, Ben, is you've got the lack of feedback, which we could add haptic feedback to screens, kind of.
Well,
and people try.
It's in labs right now, right. but it's been in labs for 5 years. We haven't seen it yet.
There's an interesting keyboard interface on the Android device, which would never work in a physical keyboard, which is normally what we're emulating, which is the dragging your fingers across the screen.
Yeah, you swipe along back and forth.
Right. So imagine that you have a touch surface where your hands never leave the surface when you're typing. Your fingers instead just move slight variations in different directions. And that's the keyboard interface. Now, you'd have to you'd train yourself to do this. But the point is that just because we're all locked to a world where we type in a traditional typing interface, mm-hmm. does not mean that that's the future of computer interaction and input. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if there's so many people buying tablet-type devices, you could see a future in which more input capabilities would emerge in that type of interface. And I don't think that is a keyboard, necessarily.
In a world where people use touchscreens more, people come up with ways to make them more usable.
Yeah.
To drive us all nuts, they could also be voice inputs.
Yes.
Oh, boy, I would like to see some improvement on that. And let's talk about that after a little bit of a break. You're listening to Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP, and we'll be right back. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, it's the softer side of primates. Psychologist Felix Warnikin searches for and finds signs of innate altruism in children and chimps. And neurobiologist Robert Sapolsky tells the most heartwarming baboon story you ever did hear. That's hosted by KUSP's Robert Pauly. It's the 7th Avenue Project, which airs every Sunday at high noon here on 88.9 KUSP. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. You can find out more information about everything we talk about at geekspeak.org under the episode show. I'm Bonnie Primshin. With me in the air room today are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Lyle Troxell, and we were just talking about how annoying voice recognition software was.
I think we were about to suggest that, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was thinking along the lines of that we are the older generation now,
yeah,
and we're going to be like, oh, you kids, all these just like noise everywhere.
Stupid.
Everyone talking into their phones. Why don't you just have a keyboard?
Yeah, get like off that.
We're totally going to be the curmudgeons.
So here's one of the things that's annoying about text to speech or speech to text is that it's vocal. We all have to hear it at the same time, right? That's why it's irritating with people who use interfaces like that nature. And it's not very good. The computers are not really capable of doing exactly what we mean.
Yeah.
Right. Most of the time it's pretty good.
Yeah, most of the time. And it's getting better.
Yeah, it's getting better. And then the audio part of it, we make the sounds we make, especially when we're doing it better than I am, by using our mouth structure and our vocal cords to vibrate air and throw it out through our harmonics in our mouth and our tongue. And theoretically, you could have a system that detected your mouth positioning and the harmonics with almost no audio coming out. So you could theoretically do sub-vocal computer control. And that's what sci-fi normally talks about, right? This idea that you're actually interfacing with your computer by speaking to it, but you never actually open your mouth. You know how to speak, and the computer can interpret what you mean without having air go through your vibrating vocal cords and all that. I don't know.
Now, there is another side to this, which is I have never seen a voice interface or a gestural interface that could match the speed of a fast touch typist. Because those folks are going much faster than how people normally how people can speak. Then again, you could have someone, the younger generation, learning how to talk very quickly.
Well, some people do know how to talk very quickly.
You know, and there's also the potential for your computer to complete and structure your sentences in a correct manner, even though you do abbreviations.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All these interesting fields of study that I really do hope they do work on.
I feel like
so much happier.
I feel like vocal recognition, everything is more theatrical. I mean, you see it in Star Trek, for example, but it's really frustrating to me when they're in a really tight spot and them talking to the computer is the slowest link in the chain. They're mm-hmm. like, computer, make an analysis of da 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 da. And then the computer's like, done, you know? So,
well, that's why Barclay, when he had augmented brain, he had to have that cerebral interface to go to the full.
And that's,
what are you
that's
talking
why they
about?
Were
episode of Next Generation.
Trying to connect.
The Barclay episodes are awesome.
Yes, I don't know about that.
And with regard to
there was a fistful of data as they were trying to connect data to that. That would have been amazing. Anyway.
Deep end. Bonnie, yeah, this is the deep end.
I just heard a little bit of spaghetti western there for a second.
So but
with regard to interface, just as a last thing to go for the other side, my folks recently came to town, and I was setting them up with technology, and having a tablet and having a Bluetooth keyboard is awesome.
All they need.
Yeah.
Is this an iPad type tablet?
It was an iPad Air.
And does the keyboard have a mounting capability so that it holds it at an angle?
No, it's using the cover to the iPad Air to tilt it up.
Right.
So it's converting the
iPad interface or the tablet interface into a normal laptop.
Right. And the keyboard is a Bluetooth, so it's not connected physically at all. It's just whenever it gets close by, that's when it connects up, and it will, you know, turn itself off automatically. You don't have to worry about it, which is the great thing.
I'm curious about TV sales in this realm too, because my family, we don't actually have a television in the house, but we have an iPad, and we watch our, you know, media stuff with the family in an iPad, unless we're in a situation where there's all five of us and we want a little bit larger, and then I pull in a computer monitor. So there seems to be, there's a space where potentially you could get rid of those large dominant features of your home of a television and replace them with small portable devices that maybe have mounts on them so that they could, you know, be viewed by multiple people or something. Anyway, to sum up this whole idea that we're not going to move necessarily to touch-type iPad tablet devices as a culture inherent all the way because of the keyboard problem, I don't really think that's the future. I think the future is a new way of interacting with computers and maybe the keyboard going away, though I can't imagine.
I don't think the keyboard's going to go away, but I do think the keyboard can be supplanted by other things. Like, for example, if you look at me, I use keyboard shortcuts all the time. I very rarely use the mouse. But I still have a mouse, like a trackpad, rather, on my laptop. Mm-hmm. I think that if gestures end up being the new, just as an example, if gestures end up being the new way that we interact with tablets and the way we type and all that stuff, and old curmudgeons like us don't learn to do the gesture thing, we'll still have a soft keyboard to fall back on and we'll be slower, but we'll still be able to do it the way we learn to do it. And your kids might learn the gesture stuff and be super duper fast. I don't know.
Some of us still have rotary phones.
Yeah, it's true.
You know?
I mean the round, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I want one.
There's one in my parents' house that was a fascination for my niece and nephew at Christmas.
Years ago, I was at a high school kind of event, and there was a rotary phone at the location at Booms. And the kid asked to use a phone, and the Boom said, yeah, go ahead and use a phone. He went over to it, and he saw the phone. He picked up the receiver, and then he just pushed his fingers into the holes of the rotary. Beautiful.
Oh, no.
I wish I'd had glass at the time. I would have videotaped the whole thing.
Yeah, remember those times, when, you know, back in the day, where you're like, wait, how many zeros does your phone number have?
Yeah. Why do you hate me?
Or like Uncle Frank, right, is taking digital photographs he's taking photographs in a regular, like an old-style film camera, and niece looks behind the camera to see what the picture looks like.
Right.
There's no picture there.
Fun fact about rotary phones. When you, let's say you dial 5, you turn the thing and then you let go, and it actually inside it goes do-do-do-do-do. Like that for the 5. So you could actually pick up the receiver and the little button that hangs up the call when the receiver's put on it, you can just push that down. Boop, 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 boop.
Not all the way.
Just really fast, like a staccato kind of boom thing.
Well, no, not all the way in the sense that you've got to disconnect, but you can't actually then engage the coil on there to denote that it's hung up. So you've got to kind of do a little...
Most
of them, it's just partial.
We're hacking
on rotary phones.
Maybe it depends, because I've done it successfully, just pushing them entirely, and there wasn't an in-between state. It was just on or off, and if you were off for a certain amount of time, then it would be hung up.
I see.
So I think that's actually how it works.
And speaking of in-between states, I also remember having a phone that had a little dial that said, do you want pulse or tone?
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
so
yeah.
even though it wasn't a rotary, you press the button and it would go...
Yeah,
yeah. Just like the old times.
Some of the exchanges didn't support tonals for a while.
We're actually getting a phone call right now.
My gosh, I've heard
of those. Ed in Paso Robles, who would like to do some voice control stuff with Linux.
Ooh, Linux.
Yeah, let's find out about that. Hi, Ed, you're on GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I want to know how to do it. Windows has it built in, but I much prefer to use Linux, and I would like to, since I'm not an expert typist, voice would be easier and faster to use than my fumbled fingers.
Yeah, yeah. And so, gentlemen who are assembled here, do we know anything about Linux and...
I have not.
Voice recognition?
Yeah, I've never tried to do it with Linux.
So there's a few software packages available.
Yeah.
The free speech recognition engines. I mean, the thing is troublesome is that there's engines that do recognition, and then there's applications wrapped around those engines because the user interface needs to be done as well. And so it's a bit of a learning curve. You're in the area in Paso Robles?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So let's see. What's the best choice? Right. That's the trouble is what the choice
you've,
is.
You've given these guys a good puzzle. Because that is the question, though, is because there's someone devising a thing that can do the thing, and then there's someone else devising a thing so that you can interact easily with that thing.
There's apparently a voice recognition program called Palaver, which actually uses Google's voice API on the back end. And it's up to you whether that's okay for you to send all of the information to Google to get transcribed and then be sent back. Chances are it'll probably be better than whatever solution you end up, whatever other solutions you have on Linux.
Well, that's good for transcriptions maybe, but is that mm-hmm. what you wanted voice control for, Ed?
Yes. To control the system.
Mm-hmm. Or you just like able to talk to the computer and have it do things.
I imagine it's go to Google and it'll be listed.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, OS X, Apple does a lot of work to make their whole operating system manageable via voice and other input devices for accessibility issues. Mm-hmm. And so the operating system itself has a lot of investment in that capability. You can turn on, suggested words. The interface can start talking to you. It's really quite nice. But in the Linux environment, I don't know if there's any distros that are specifically targeted for that. When I say distros, I mean a distribution of Linux because Linux is core, of course, open source. So there's the speech recognition part of it that actually translates your voice into text. But then there's the control side of it, which is actually the user interface of the computer. And that's another level of complexity. Normally, you don't actually want like a perfect English sentence of like open Microsoft Office now, especially Linux because it's not available. But you really want the interface saying here are your tabs currently, reading off your tabs, and you can say select and then you say what it said, right? So there's kind of the interface quality. I think OS X's ahead of the game on that.
It's
right now.
It's pretty good. It's called VoiceOver on OS X.
Yeah.
Now one thing that could be a possibility is that Google Chrome does have speech built into the browser, the web speech API, and I believe it's accessible through extensions, and those extensions can be done through a desktop.
Okay, so there's standalone. Apple, there's Google, and he's asking about Linux.
But that's the thing, though.
Can Linux interact with those things?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so if you have Chrome installed, there may be plugins or extensions available.
Yeah, but that
assumes
that you want to go through the web browser. It's not something that's just a library on
can
the
you,
operating system.
Can you install Chrome OS on a normal machine? Anyone know?
Yeah,
you could just
install Chrome on Linux.
So now there's Chrome and there's Chrome OS, and the operating system of Chrome is like a minimized Linux version, which runs the Chrome browser.
When I was talking about apps, I didn't mean that.
I'm talking about the browser.
I'm talking about potentially Chrome OS could be your OS if it's got good voice recognition. I just don't know if it does. I'm going to link on the GeekSpeak website, which is geekspeak.org, and we're listening to the February 8th show, a link to the Wikipedia article about this topic because there is a whole speech recognition on Linux Wikipedia article that I think you might want to start with at least.
Thank you. I could even smell all the sawdust burning down here with my question.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, they were grinding the gears there.
It's actually, I think
thank
the chain got too hot.
And so,
thank you very much.
Right. Cheers, Ed. Thanks for calling. Well, Ed knew to call us at 800-655-5877 with his question. Perhaps you've got one, too, or a comment that you'd like to make about the show. Go ahead and give us a call. And special thanks, by the way, to Rick Philman for fielding those calls for us. Lyle, you mentioned that it is February 8th.
It is. You know, in 1974, which would be 40 years ago today, mm-hmm. after 84 days in space, the crew of Skylab 4, mm-hmm. the last crew to visit the American Space Station, Skylab, returned to Earth. So this was kind of the leaving of Space Lab was 40 years ago today, yeah. which is amazing to me.
That's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. Anyway, that's February 8th, and of course the episode today is February 8th
as well. This is the February 8th episode. Hey, do we have any geek bits? I could use a geek bit.
I've got a geek bit. So...
And by the way, geek bit, this is a, mm-hmm. we call it a geek bit. Really, it's a geek visual. These are things that make for lousy radio because you really got to see it to really appreciate it.
Yeah. Occasionally, I've come across ones that are not visual necessarily, but they're just things that are difficult to describe on the air, you know?
And like this quantum theory.
This one is a visual one. Perhaps you've heard of the Atlas of Historical Geography of the United States.
I haven't heard about that. What is that, Ben?
That was published before we were all born in 1932. And first published, and it's one of the great historical atlases by Charles O. Paulin and John K. Wright. Mm. And there are a lot of really great maps in this thing. Now, this is an actual atlas that you'd hold in your hand. Well, it turns out that recently the entire thing was digitized. Ooh. And the cool thing about that is not only can you go and look at the maps that you would see in the hard copy that mm-hmm. you could buy, but you can actually watch them animate.
What?
Because, like, for example, here are a couple of the maps. Like, there's a map of the presidents and who voted, like what areas voted for each president. Now, you could look at the map for a particular year, or you could look at all the maps kind of superimposed, and you can animate through.
So you can sort of see over time how mm-hmm. that map looked from year to year.
Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of things. There's like distribution of wealth is one of the maps, military history, political parties and opinions, boundaries. And these maps are from, I mean, the earliest actually go back to 1492.
I want to see that.
Yeah, I'll show you. Here, check it out.
Okay.
1492 to 1930. So that's a range of time. That's a pretty big range. There are all these different chapters, and I started watching the political candidates and like who won in different elections and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was so surprised because when I clicked on the first map, it was, of course, everyone voted for George Washington
uh-huh.
because
that's just, all there was.
That was all there was. But the thing that surprised me that for some reason I didn't think of is the United States was a lot smaller back then. It was just on the right side. So you see the East Coast, and everyone's right. like, you know, all blue, George Washington.
Yeah.
And then as
nobody
you go through...
Nobody out here voted for him.
Right. As you go through, you see all these presidential candidates who voted for them, and you see the United States expanding, which in thinking about it in a historical context...
So you get a lot more information by looking at it sequentially than you would... It's more than the sum of its parts, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. It's also a little bit terrifying, some of the things, you know, like you look at population and you look at the slave trade and the colored population maps from the 1800s and the 1900s. It's like the history is there, too, and it's kind of frightening.
Right.
But it's really cool.
I was thinking, you have the election of James K. Polk, and all of a sudden there's a whole lot of new states.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
That's true.
It's like, whoa. Okay.
Well, I'm excited to see that at geekspeak.org. It is sort of a moving, it's a four-dimensional atlas, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, we never were able to do that before.
No. Hey, speaking of politicking, there's plenty of places where geekery and politics overlap. Miles, you've been looking into this a bit. Look-alike websites, that's been a popular activist kind of method. I know the Yes Men will mm-hmm. often take on a look-alike governmental website and or corporate website and try to lure people interacting with them instead of the actual entity they're trying
right.
to reach.
This, what I'm about to describe is not a new phenomenon. However, it is becoming more and more common. We've always had the issue of what we call domain parking, mm-hmm. People registering a domain and for the purposes of, well, we may use it sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for political reasons, you may have someone say, oh, this person looks like they're going to run. Let's register the domain name that would be likely for them. And then we'll say all sorts of bad things about them. And at the same time, we'll put in a box so that when they click to donate,
mm-hmm.
it donates to the opposition.
Oh, that's dirty tricks.
Right. And it's not exactly the smallest print to say, yes, by the way, you're donating to the opposition.
But it's not an obvious place. They had to put it someplace where you don't really pay attention.
It'll have a big picture of the candidate that they don't want to win.
Yeah.
And then later on, it's like, oh, yeah, and donate here. So this has actually been the case in Florida.
That's where it's happening now.
Yeah, this is this particular case, which you can read about on geekspeak.org after the show.
Geekspeak.org.
Where a doctor decided he wanted to make a donation in a little race. He looks up, you know, Googled the name of the candidate he wanted to find. Mm-hmm, he clicked on the most popular link, which, you know, by certain algorithms, whoever links to it the most gets who wins.
Yeah.
And you saw that and was like, oh, yeah, that looks like my candidate that has the right color scheme.
Sure, that's, donate.
Okay. Yeah. And then he finds out that he donated to
the opposition.
Yes, the National Republican Congressional Committee.
So what do you do about something like that if you find that you've fallen in for one of these fake-o sites?
Don't believe the internet. Well, first lies to you.
Well, first of all, you tell your story to Forbes, and then they post your
that's good.
Story to the press.
Embarrass
the doers.
And as I said, this isn't brand new. This has actually been going on and is becoming a more common practice.
Well, that really speaks to the need for tech literacy, and we'll talk about that more when we come back. This is Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP. Stay tuned. And it's Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, talking with Lyle Troxell, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe.
So, Bonnie, you mentioned politics and coding, and you know, I'm a big proponent of everyone learning how to program. I think it's essential for, you know, whatever. Yes, you can hold old versions of the episode of Geek Speak about talking about that. But basically, the UK has done something kind of great, and the reason I heard about this is because of the fallback on it. Unfortunately, the Tory government put in a new position of director of coding initiative. This is the person that will make sure that a new program, which I'll talk about in a second, will emerge and be successful. And unfortunately, the person that was assigned as the coding executor cannot code and can't really explain what coding is. Not such a win, and is a bit of
like an episode of In the Loop.
A little bit of that. A little bit of that. So, but the thing that's kind of exciting about this is that the UK government, current government, has initiated a £500,000 fund to inspire the future of tech experts, and this is basically to bring software coding into education. And so that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. So they made a little mistake in having the public representation of a person not actually be able to code, which is kind of a fall in the face. Yeah. But the program itself is great, and I want to see more of it.
It doesn't take away from the value of the program itself.
That's right. Just a little mention.
Okay, we hope they get that. And there's something similar happening stateside, an attempt to make computer programming be a little bit more legitimate, at least as a language, Miles.
This would be the flip side of the government intervention. The Kentucky Senate had passed a bill to let computer programming be a foreign language as a requirement for graduation.
No.
Tell me why.
I don't like that idea.
Right.
No, go on, Miles. Sorry.
Well, yeah, it's that. Well, you can either take Spanish, you can take French, or you can take C++. Like that.
I see what the objection. It doesn't take away from the need to understand how to talk to people from elsewhere.
It completely ignores the reason why the requirement exists, which is the point behind a foreign language requirement is to adapt the way that you think and do so in such a way that you are able to communicate with a wider range of people.
Under those criteria, you could argue that a computer program language would satisfy that requirement because you're able to do more by knowing it.
Both Ben
and it exercises a different part of the brain than if you're just yapping in English.
Ben knows how to code. Lyle and I are both professional programmers.
Yeah.
Software engineer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm a programmer too. What are you talking about?
Yeah, Ben, you teach programming.
I teach programming. If you can't do it, you teach it, right? No.
You take away programming.
I'm just a freelancer.
We can still communicate.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's a common hobby, but it is not. It's very much not the same thing.
Bonnie, why do we teach foreign language in high school? Why do we do that?
I thought it was so that we could communicate with other people from other places.
So it's about
people.
And we
have a little more access to the wider world.
Right. So it's about people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Computer programming is about engineering machines to do things to you for you, right? So it's equivalent to saying instead of a foreign language, you can become a mechanic. I mean, yes, it's a language, and yes, there's a lot of analogies to communication in it, but you're not communicating with a computer, with right. a computer language. Computer language is not about communication. It's about telling.
It's communication is a two-way thing.
Yeah, communication is a two-way thing.
Yeah, okay. It's about the formulation of logic. Mm-hmm. So computer programming and computer science specifically is a branch of mathematics.
Yes.
It's about logic. It's about critical thinking.
So it doesn't
which
help.
Is a, and language, I can safely say at this point that learning a language is not about critical thinking or logic.
Especially if you're trying to learn English. I'm sorry. On behalf of right. non-English speakers or English speakers everywhere, I'm sorry, non-native English speakers for right. our language.
When I was in yeah. Mexico, I had someone that I was working with ask me, how do kids learn English? Like, what are the tips? And I'm like, English isn't learned. It's memorized.
Yeah. I mean, we just kind of like swim
you're
in
just
the soup.
You just hate English. But let me just say,
yes, I hate my native language. You're absolutely
the thing,
right.
Lyle. The thing is, there is some synonym. I mean, there's some similar qualities of language learning that programming languages do have, and that mm-hmm. is the ability to think in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, when you actually do learn a foreign language, another language, you actually have to construct your thoughts in that language, and therefore you are going to think a certain way. Mm-hmm. And there's really interesting discussions and philosophy about this. Mm-hmm. Computer programming is the same way. In fact, you learn different programming languages because you want to solve the problem better in a different language. It can affect that more appropriately. So that there's a similarity in that respect. But I think that language learning is about people interaction. Computer programming learning is not about people.
Yeah.
Right.
So this bill in the Kentucky Senate is the new ketchup is the new vegetable. Ketchup is a vegetable.
Yes.
Computer programming is a satisfies foreign language requirement.
I'll go with that.
Yeah.
So government yeah, no mistake.
So Geekspeak, yeah, this is a this seems like we're agreed thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Yeah.
Wah, sorry, Kentucky. Wah. That's a miss. Okay, and in the sort of upside of helping people out with their technology, this idea of a kill switch for smartphones has been rattling around, and there's been frustration along the lines of, why can't we order cable channels a la carte? And it sounds like something's actually happening with that now. There's a new bill. Miles, do you know something about that?
Yes, there is a new bill to have a kill switch in case your phone is – the idea is in case your phone is stolen.
Yeah, if it gets stolen, then you want people not to have access to all the goodies in there.
Right. This was introduced by a California legislator. However, I have some misgivings about this one as well.
Oh, noes. As we say in cheeseburger speak.
Well, when I think of, for example, my iPhone. Mm-hmm. My iPhone has the ability for me to – I can install an app that allows me to from a computer or from another iOS device that I control that has been given permission to find where my phone is and to remotely wipe it
right.
And disable it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is already being taken care of in
your
the public
particular
sector.
Phone.
Yeah, I worry tinfoil hat again.
Okay.
I worry about yes, we're going to demand that cell phones have this kill switch. These smartphones have this
kill
switch.
And then other people can kill it.
Yeah, I do worry about
is that it?
The fact that, like, how would it be implemented? How would it be implemented? Is it going to be, oh, I called into the cops, my phone has been stolen, so then they have this access to do yeah. the kill switch.
It's just the problem with it is that a cell phone becomes more and more what your identity is. My cell phone right now has my authentication methodology, my second factor authentication for multiple services that I have. I theoretically can do bank transfers and stuff in other ways, but the way I do it is my phone. Like my phone represents me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And to say that the government can decide that that thing no longer is active would be similar to quieting my voice as well.
Right. There also is the aspect of the intended people that you would have to use the service is not always and oftentimes is rarely the only people who use it.
Yeah.
If you put this functionality in there and you put it in a uniform way for a third party to be able to handle it, it also opens up the opens up room for malicious actors, black hat hackers,
it's just a really
break
bad
in the
idea.
System and yeah. then wipe out a whole lot of people's
and
devices,
as you, said,
as you were saying, that are very important to
yeah,
people.
Yeah, and as you
lives.
Said, Miles, we already have these features embedded in phones. In fact, iOS has it, Microsoft's phone system has it, Android has it, mm-hmm. and it's used for corporate environments where you and I think Miles and I both have mm-hmm. this on our phones because we use...
There's too much proprietary information.
We have work email, and if I lose our phone, we want to wipe it remotely. So we've yeah. given the privilege of the operating system for have this application be able to do that. That was a choice that I made.
Yeah.
I don't want that to be embedded in the device inherently.
Okay.
It's the wrong way to go about it.
Or enables in the device inherently. Yeah.
That's right.
Thinking back to the story of the Ukraine sending texts to protesters, hey, we knew you were at that protest. Mm-hmm. And they could easily say, okay, if I know who you are and can communicate with directly on your phone, then perhaps I can just kill your phone so that you cannot
protest. Protest is over. Now people can't organize.
Okay. All right. I get it. Yeah. The tin hat. I'm in for the tinfoil hat. Very good. A really loud sound system. Ben, I'm just going to say those words to you, and you say more.
What are you talking? Oh, I have a story about that.
Yeah.
This is really cool. So I first read it's an insanely loud sound system. It's it can make sounds upward of 154 decibels.
That's not for people.
Why?
No, that's not for people. How do you know? So the loudest concerts in the world were somewhere between 126 and 136 decibels. That was irresponsible by the sound engineers. That was Kiss and AC/DC and Led Zeppelin. Some of their concerts
irresponsible
were
irresponsible because ears hurt.
Yeah, because okay, so a couple.
Well, can we do some background on decibels? Just because not everyone is familiar with that curve. That just to know that 100 decibels is not twice
it's
as loud
logarithmic.
As 50.
Yeah, it's 10 times as loud.
Oh,
it's 10
yeah,
times the energy. So basically, okay. if you go from 50 to 60 decibels, you're multiplying the intensity by 10 times.
It's like
from 60 to 70, it's another 10 times.
Okay.
So like a Walkman at maximum level is 160 decibels. Instant perforation of the eardrum is 160 decibels. So
they're basically building a weapon. is this really loud sound system for?
This really loud sound system is for testing satellites that are going to space. Because when you send a satellite to space, it has to be put on a rocket and sent to space. And rockets are really loud. And it's not just that they're loud. I mean, you know, like humans go in rockets, but humans go in rockets in these acoustically padded chambers, right?
Yeah.
But also all the vibrations and everything. That's really what sound is.
Oh, so it's for testing a satellite
cool.
to see
yeah.
if it can handle the loud boominess that comes with mm-hmm. getting shot into space.
Mm-hmm. So they've got these giant sound horns on the wall, these huge sound horns, and they inject them with nitrogen in this way that produces these ridiculously loud sounds. And they produce sounds that are upwards of 154 decibels. So 154 wow. decibels is what you would hear if you stood next to several rockets taking off.
Wow, cool.
And as I said, 160 is the instant perforation of the eardrum. If you're exposed to this for like 2 or 3 seconds, you're deaf for the rest of your life. So it doesn't work unless the door's been closed.
Oh, good.
And
good
nobody's
decision.
Inside.
Good decision.
That's a good idea. That's a good fail-safe.
It's just kind of wacky that we can build these things, and there's actually a reason for us to build these. Like, that's
I'm
just
sure
weird.
They'll stay in the right hands. Everything's going to be fine.
Check it out at geekspeak.org. There's more details in this story up there.
Cool.
Let's see. Did we get another?
How about from Marina, we got Jerry.
Oh, great.
Hi, Jerry. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, guys and lady. I listen to you guys every weekend when I get a chance. I'm not a techie. I just use a laptop for my work, and I need to back up. I've got two older laptops, one of which I dropped right on the DVD drive,
mm-hmm.
and that disabled that. Another one, the replacement I used, I picked up a super bad virus. It just basically wiped out, corrupted everything. They're both Vista Home Premium.
Oh, so they're not that old a machine.
They're not. Well, yeah. The oldest one I have was back to like 2008, 2009. But anyway, I've got. I need to fix one for a backup. I need to. The other one I'm going to donate to a friend who needs a laptop. And I want to upgrade. I know I can. I've been able to find a replacement DVD drive online.
Mm-hmm. And you don't need a DVD drive. You can just not have a DVD drive as well. So the question really is: it worth your time to do this? And what operating system?
More or less, more or less. What's the issues as far as reinstalling an update like Windows 7, Windows 8 on the old Vista? Because
I think don't go to Windows 8. That would be crazy. But you could go to Windows 7 probably if it can run Vista. You could also just do an Ubuntu.
Crazy?
Windows 8?
Yeah. Windows 8.1 where it has a start button again.
Yeah, but this is a Vista machine, so there's no point. Windows 7 is an awesome operating system,
yes,
comparatively.
Windows
7 is an awesome operating system. Just go with Windows 7. Don't do Vista. So my since we've got 3 minutes left on the show, Ubuntu or Linux or some Linux distribution, which would be great, or go ahead and go with 7.
Okay.
All right?
Okay. And as far as not needing a DVD drive, because
I
update my programs with a disk.
Yeah, so what you'd have to do is you'd have to get an external drive or use another hard drive, and that's a little tricky. So maybe replacing the optics drive might be worth it. But the thing is, it's going to be so expensive compared to what the machine is worth. It's hard to say you should do that.
External drives, though, they're great. They're always
useful.
They're cheap. They're fast enough. And after you're done with that laptop, you can use them again someplace else.
Yeah, get an external CD drive, and then just won't use. Yeah, you just plug it in when you need it. Good luck.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
And do we want to take one of these Marina calls?
I don't think we've got time.
We don't have time.
I bet Ben's got some other special stories sitting around in his.
I'm going to steal Miles' story. Audience jeers contestants who uses game theory to win at Jeopardy.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't I like that?
Yeah.
He's using his brain. That's what we like about that show.
In a nutshell, Jeopardy is not. Like the way that they set up the clues is not random. They want to make it really nice and fun to listen to for the audience. So they need to reference things that the audience would recognize. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like a female scientist might be Marie Curie more often than the number of female scientists, you know? So basically what he did is he did that, and he also searched for daily doubles, which statistically occur more in the lower
two rows, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he kind of knew where to get them, the daily doubles, and so he'd always try to target those ones.
Mm-hmm. Statistically, yeah.
Cool.
Instead of going 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, he would go straight to... Or 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, go 40,
so
50.
Using game theory to beat Jeopardy.
He's very not cool. The first one.
Hey, last week we talked about the Bucky McPhister Fuller show, and I saw it in San Jose. It was great. It's running till the 23rd. So if you're in Central California, go see the Bucky show, and you can learn more about that from geekspeak.org and hear the interview from last week.
All right, great. Well, this has been Geekspeak for February 8th, 2014. It's a registered service mark of David Lawrence, Geekspeak is, and used with permission. Thanks. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. And to find out more, go to geekspeak.org.